The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, To the Moon and Back, kind of, NASA astronaut Captain Victor Glover talks about his career and preparing for that historic moon mission.
About 10 years old, seeing a shuttle launch on TV, it was motivating and inspiring, but I didn't have a real connection. I didn't see steps, and I definitely didn't see anybody in my life that I could mimic or ask questions about how to get there.
And speaking of representation, Kennesaw State's future Mr. Academy introduces middle and high school students to life as an educator. Those conversations coming up, but first this. Expect another long Atlanta City Council meeting today due to the public comment portion. That's because when the Finance Committee meets, they will vote to specifically approve initial funding for construction of the new Public Safety Training Center. Now, per the initial agreement, Atlanta is to allocate $30 million to the Atlanta Police Foundation for the controversial facility, but that amount has since increased to over $33 million. If approved, the vote then goes to full council on Monday, June 5th. In other news, Georgia's upcoming state-based health insurance marketplace now has a director. Now, Georgia Access will allow residents to choose an Affordable Care Act plan outside of the federal health insurance marketplace. And Jess Mador has more.
Executive Director Cheryl Gardner will oversee Georgia Access. She previously worked on other state exchanges in New Mexico, Arkansas, and Utah. Georgia's new state-based marketplace is already under construction and could be up by the fall. Georgia Access is expected to offer plans already found on the federal site, healthcare.gov. It may also offer additional state options. Nearly 900,000 Georgians are signed up through the federal exchange. 18 other states already operate similar marketplaces. Jess Mador, WABE News.
And finally, veteran Atlanta journalist Maynard Eaton has died. Eaton, a multi-award-winning journalist, was known for reporting with a focus on the fight for social change, a career that spanned over five decades. Maynard Eaton did it all as a journalist, including a reporter for the Atlanta Voice and also teaching at Clark Atlanta University, and most recently served as an endowed professor at the Scripps Howard School of Journalism and Communications at Hampton University. In a statement, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens said of Eaton, quote, his persistence and dedication to informing his audiences earned him numerous awards, but also the trust and respect of the community, close quote. And I'll add this. I met Maynard Eaton in the late 90s as I was starting my career here in Atlanta. I always enjoyed talking to him about politics, civil rights, and, of course, sports. He was a champion for younger Black journalists. And I think just as significant, Maynard also understood the importance of the Black press and not just reporting about social change or issues, but also staying connected to the Black community. I'll miss you, my friend. Maynard Eaton was 73 years old. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey. And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. There's a dire need for more black male educators in our nation's classrooms. That's according to data gathered from the National Teacher and Principal Survey in 2021. Now, it's estimated U.S. black teachers make up just about 7% of all public school faculty. That number is even lower for black male educators, just about 2% of all public teachers in the U.S. Now, despite this shortage, students of color make up more than half of the student population in our nation's public schools. The data also reveals the benefit of having a black male teacher in a classroom are far-reaching and can make significant impact on the outcomes of students of color. Call Me Mister, which stands for Mentors Instructing Students Toward Effective Role Models, was created to increase the pipeline of black male teachers at the college level. And out of that program, to reach students way before they get to college, Future Misters Academy was created. So join me now to talk all about is Dr. Jabari Kane, an associate professor in the Bagwell College of Education and the director of the Call Me Mister program at Kennesaw State, and Alexander Shannon, a TAP middle school teacher and community partner in KSU's Call Me Mister program. Professor Kane, Alexander, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm going to say something that might be shocking. From K through, I think, eighth grade, I never had a black male teacher. And I didn't have one in high school either.
go ahead, Dr. Kane.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead, Dr. Kane.
I was going to say that's not shocking at all. I only had one from K through 12.
I only had one,
and that was in seventh or eighth grade, and that was the only one that I had.
Wow. So when I gave that statistic coming into this program, and that's not lost on you that it's so high. It's a low percentage, rather, in terms of black male educators in public schools.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. It's a statistic that we are definitely trying to improve upon. And I think that just one person can make a difference, as far as the community is concerned. So, you know, that's the main purpose of the Call Me Mister program at KSU. We want to reach out to the community. We also want to reach out to those that are already in education, those black males and also males of color, to recruit and retain their presence in the College of Ed.
And so, correct me if I'm wrong, the Call Me Mister program, it actually started at Clemson University. Is that correct?
That's correct. With I want to say three other universities. They're smaller universities, but Clemson is like the motherland, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And how did you were able to bring this to Kennesaw State? What's the backstory here?
Yeah, we were able to bring the Call Me Mister program in the fall of 2021. By Dr. Corey Fountain. She's at another university. And after Dr. Fountain, there was Dr. Glenn, who was there, who was the director last year. Mm-hmm. And then he moved on and I took over the role. So this is going on my first year and in my first year as the director of the Call Me Mister program. And it's been a great experience so far. I've had the opportunity to meet some great individuals within the community, such as Mr. Shannon. So I'm glad he's here as well.
Well, we're going to talk about that because Alexander Shannon, this Future Misters Academy, it's a 3-day summer camp. Tell our listeners what's going to take place.
Well, I'll defer that to Dr. Glenn and I'll just echo a few of his comments.
Okay, let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So pretty much the Future Misters Academy gives these students an opportunity, and we're targeting African-American males, of course, but it gives them the opportunity to see for the first time for some a college campus. And even if it's right around the corner, we have a lot of students, middle and high school students from Cobb County. Some of those students may have never been to KSU's campus. So we want to enlighten them to be on campus. Within that 3-day program, you know, they'll be able to go to the commons to eat a meal. It's that whole college life experience. I'll be doing a lecture as a professor myself. My background is technology, and then also a tour of the campus. And we also have on the third day, we have an enrichment activity, and that's the students going to Adventure Air Sports. So we really want to enlighten them to a college experience, and hopefully they'll go to KSU, yeah. But for the most part, we want them in education. That's what's most important.
So exactly. Go ahead.
The student group we took last year, they absolutely loved the tour of the campus. But I think the most and they love the seminars as well. But I think the most exciting part of their 3-day activity was probably eating in the commons. They absolutely enjoy just going to that cafeteria and being able to eat whatever they wanted to eat and really how much ever yeah. they wanted to eat. So it was a great enriching experience because three of the four kids that we took had never gone to a KSU, and two of them had never stepped foot on a college campus before.
Wow.
So
wow.
It was a great experience for them.
Go ahead.
I was just about to say one young man said, he was like, I think I'm going to go to KSU.
Well,
what are our middle schoolers?
And what I wanted to add to that, Alexander, is that just even that small, short period of time on a college campus can do so much. And then you're also going to be talking about, hey, maybe you might want to think about being an educator. And I'm curious, what questions do kids have for you, Alexander?
As it relates to education, the kids, when Dr. Glenn last year was doing one of the seminars and he was talking about the statistics, and the kids could, they were awestruck about, the low percentage of African-American males in education. Because at our school, at TAP, we've got several African-American male educators, but that's not the case in so many other places around the country. So when he was going over those statistics, I think they were just in awe of that.
And so, Professor Kane, when we talk about, elementary and middle school students, you want to meet them there at that young of age. And also, we also know what research reveals about if you're able to get a kid, a black youth by third grade, how important that is if you can get them on the right track.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes a difference. It makes an impact. Just a little bit about my background. I was a first grade teacher for 2 years. And one of the things that I did was I always wore a tie to the classroom and every day. And towards the end of the year, I remember one of my students, he came to school with a tie on, and he basically said that he was mimicking me. So just like you mentioned, Rose, you never know how students are looking at you, how your kids are looking at you. So you always want to have that positive impact. And you want to have those positive mentors as well within the community. So, we're very much appreciative of people like Mr. Shannon.
Professor Kane, how many students are y'all able to take for these 3 days?
So we have, currently we have 15, and this is the last day of school, so those numbers may increase.
Mm-hmm.
My sons might be coming. I have a seventh grader, but he's going on eighth grade now, and I have a 10th grader, he's going into 11th grade, and I do want them to have that college experience. So I know Mr. Glenn last year, he brought his son, and I think I might be doing the same.
Yeah.
So it helps with, activities like such as this to help to market the program. That's why we love to have Mr. Shannon. I mean, he's the boots on the ground. At least half of the individuals that are coming to the Future Misters Academy are from TAP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that says a lot. That just says a lot. So we're truly appreciative of individuals like Mr. Shannon.
And Educator Shannon, you're giving your time to this in hopes of inspiring, future leaders. What do you tell other educators? 3 days, that's only 3 days. I know for some folks, school is out. But,
right.
Yeah.
What do we definitely want to get more black male educators involved in this endeavor. Sorry about that. It's not a hard sell. So the more exposure that we can get with the program, the more that we can get the word out, the more volunteers that we can get, and the more students that we can recruit. So
do you get feedback from the students, from the young boys? Do you ask them, say, hey, what'd you like about it? What could we do maybe different next year?
Yes, the feedback. As a matter of fact, three of the young men who went last year. They're going back again this year. And they asked me probably in April, hey, are we having that program that we went to KSU to do? I'm like, yeah, we will have that program. And they said, yes, I'm on board with that.
And yeah. Go ahead, Professor Kane.
That really, really excites me for those individuals that were there last year that they want to come back. You know, when I was growing up, I was in a program called KCP at Michigan State University for King Chavez Parks. And it was similar to the Call Me Mr. program. So it just helps to have something, you know, similar here at KSU.
You know, when we came into this segment and I talked about the very low statistics in terms of Black male educators, what do you think that number would be successful? I mean, when I ask this question, I think Rose don't ask that question because we rely so much on data. But, you know, if we're talking about just 2%, 2% are Black male teachers in our public schools. You know, is there an acceptable number that you think in the future would say, okay, we're making some progress here? I mean,
Mr. Shannon?
Is he still with us?
Okay.
I'm still here. Yeah, I think that number should, it should represent the population. Mm-hmm. So if we're 13% of the population, 14% of the population, it should mimic the population. Mm-hmm. It should actually be greater. So the benefit is not just for our African-American male students or minority students. That diversity benefits everyone. Every single student benefits from that.
And you are at school, correct? Because I hear those announcements.
Yeah. I do apologize. It's okay. Currently at school right now.
It's okay. What are they talking about? It's time to go to lunch. What's happening? Is there something we should know about?
It's actually our last day dismissal. So there's a lot of things that are currently happening right now as we speak.
That's all right. Now, nothing like a good school announcement.
Rose, I'll add to that. We have the Call Me Mr. program actually has webinars throughout the school year, and Mr. Shannon was so gracious enough to join us. And one thing that he did mention during that webinar is that we don't want just African-American male teachers. We want good African-American male teachers. Mm-hmm. We definitely want to keep that in mind, because everybody that, you know, graduates from school, from college, doesn't mean that you're a right fit in the classroom. Mm-hmm. You really, really, really have to connect to these students, because they have a lot going on mm-hmm. These days. You know, I was teaching 2003, 2004, you know, 20 years later, with the introduction of social media and cell phones, a lot has changed. So, mm-hmm. So I just wanted to put that out there.
And for Professor Kane and Educator Shannon, and I know it's not lost on you when you hear the plight of what's happening with, particularly with our young Black males. We don't need to go down the list because we know what it is here. And what concerns you have, though, in terms of the future and making sure that there are, whether it's your programs or other mentoring programs. I think of other folks I have on the show often, you know, CJ and Kelly Stewart with their lead ambassador programs and what you all are doing. I've just heard Rose is simply not enough. We need to have more options for our young Black males to lead them down this path as opposed to something else.
Yeah, we've just got to do whatever we can, whenever we can, and how much we can do to make an impact, because that's what it's about, making an investment in someone else. You know, teachers changed the trajectory of my life. So without the teachers that I had in junior high school then, I don't even know if I would be where I am right now. I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Because I particularly think about two teachers I had, Ms. Pruitt and Ms. Leeper. They changed who I was mm-hmm. and made me see myself in a different light. So yeah. they changed my life. Yeah. And so that I'm trying to do exactly what they did for me, for these students that I impact every single day.
And Professor Kane, I imagine you had the same experience.
Yeah, no, I would echo those thoughts, not only in the classroom, but, you know, growing up, Pee Wee League football, you know, those coaches weren't getting paid. Yeah, and they're having a huge impact. You know, my father, loved him to death. He wanted us around. The the side of town that wasn't the richest side of town. He wanted us involved in that. He wanted us to just be diverse, mm-hmm. in a sense. And programs such as the football program, I was in, it was called the Alpha Esquires. Mm-hmm. That was a group dedicated to African-American male individuals in high school. And, you know, my advisor still to this day, his name is R.L. Hester.
Yeah.
I still reach out to him because he had an impact on my life. So I want to keep that going, for myself, and just, pass that down as a parent. I just think of myself as this is what I want you all, I want you all to, I lead by example, if gotcha. You will. So gotcha. I just want to make sure my children and students that they have a similar kind of well-being.
All right. The Future Mister's Academy runs from June 7th to 9th on the campus of Kennesaw State. Dr. Jabari Kane, an associate professor in the Bagwell College of Education and the director of the Call Me Mister program at Kennesaw State, and Alexander Shannon, a TAP middle school teacher and community partner in KSU's Call Me Mr. program. Thank you both for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for what you're going to do for so many young fellas around. I appreciate that. I really do. Shout out to all my teachers who had to deal with me, because I know it was something.
Thank you for this great opportunity.
Thanks.
Well, there's a reason we're playing this song. Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Perhaps this next statement is appropriate. In order to better the future, we can always look to the past.
At the foot of the ladder, the limb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine.
And, of course, that is the voice there of Neil Armstrong. Let's go back. July 20th, 1969, Apollo 11, the first manned mission to land on the moon.
That's one small step for man,
and how many times have we heard that? But even before that eventful moment, there was Project Mercury, which was the first U.S. program to put humans in space. In fact, there would be 25 flights, 6 of which carried astronauts between 1961 and 1963. From then till now, 6 decades in the making, and the United States space program is preparing yet for another mission. And so it was announced this past April 3rd.
I'm Christina Cook. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Jeremy Hansen. I'm a mission specialist.
I'm Victor Glover. I'm the pilot.
I'm Reed Wiseman. I'm the commander for the Artemis II mission to the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
To the moon.
I can't believe there's not a journalist. Artemis II! NASA's first crewed flight test of the Space Launch System rocket, an Orion spacecraft around the moon. As to why, well, my next guest can explain it far better than I can. Captain Victor Glover Jr., the pilot for Artemis II, the mission. Well, he's always been pretty busy here lately these days, but he's taking time for a closer look and joining us from NASA. Captain Glover, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for having me, Rose. Happy to be here this morning.
I asked you before we came on air, what time do you get up?
Between 5 and 5:30. I'm a morning person, but also I've got kids in high school, and it starts early these days.
Now, are you checking homework too to make sure?
One of my favorite things. I tried to do it when I was on the International Space Station, and it was a little harder, a little more logistically challenging. But that's one of my favorite things to do, is to help my kids with their schoolwork.
Wow. Well, where do we begin? And I believe it was your fellow crew member, Jeremy Hansen, that referred to this mission as, quote, an ambitious goal for humanity, close quote. I'll let you take that further for our listeners and how important this mission is.
Yes, this is the first time humans are going to ride the Space Launch System rocket, supported by our exploration ground systems that gets us out to and from the launch pad, and to ride inside of the Orion spacecraft. So it's a test mission, but really this is the beginning of humanity's journey back out further into space, into deep space beyond low Earth orbit, where our International Space Station currently orbits with seven humans on board. And so it's been since December of 1972 that humanity has been confined to low Earth orbit. We stopped going to the moon then. And this is the beginning of a journey, not just to get back to the moon sustainably and responsibly, but also this is enabling us to create the technology, but also to build the teams that are going to be necessary for going on to Mars.
And for someone listening saying, okay, listen, we know this is a 10-day flight, Artemis II flight test, but in as simple as you can put it, someone saying, what in the world, or rather, what in the outer world, will y'all be doing?
So we're going to test the spacecraft. We're going to make sure that humans can survive in this spacecraft for 10 days. And once we know that, then we can do more challenging and bigger things. We can dock to a lander spacecraft and go to the surface of the moon. That'll enable us to go to a space station type of vehicle that is orbiting the moon and stays around the moon. So this one mission is really what I call part of a relay race. This is a relay race, and we have the baton, but we will be passing the baton on to more and more complex missions that will advance science and technology.
And Captain, this mission, like many others, requires a lot of folks. You know, you have an astronaut corps that includes dozens of scientists, engineers, technicians, and I'm just naming a few here. What's the total number of personnel designated, devoted to Artemis II?
Wow, you know, that's a great question. And Rose, I'm actually going to go find out because I don't know exactly, but I can tell you there are thousands of people involved all around the world. I mean, just in this country, I could list some company or school or a NASA center in every state, every one of our 50 states that has a part in this SLS, Space Launch System rocket, the ground systems or the Orion spacecraft. But then to control it, we have control centers all over the world. Mm-hmm. Part of our spacecraft, the service module, is built by a European aerospace company. And, you know, we have a Canadian on board, the first non-American that will leave low Earth orbit and get into the vicinity of the moon. So we have thousands of people all over the world. And I'm going to find out what that number is and get back to you.
I want it on record that I asked Captain Glover, a man who has IKE, which stands for I Know Everything, and I asked you something and you didn't know the answer.
Well, you know how nicknames work. You know, they call the bald-headed guy Curly. You know, they call So you know how that works, right?
Let's go back even a little bit further, because you've been on missions to the International Space Station, I believe in 2020 and back in 2021. How different, Captain Glover, is the technical and then the physical preparation for this type of mission, which, by the way, folks, is it's not like he's leaving tomorrow. They're all going next year in November, right? 2024 or somewhere around there.
Correct. It's currently planned for November of next year. And we will go, though, when the vehicle and the software and the teams are ready. And so The physical and technical preparation for this mission, it will be different. It's not getting ready for a six-month-long mission. You know, you go to the space station, and it's home and work. That's more like leaving to go to college. You have to prepare to move out and go live somewhere else. Even though you may still get mail at home at your parents' house, you're moving across the state, across town, across the country, and you're planning to be there a while. This mission is more like going on a camping trip. Home is still home, and you're going in this very high-tech tent. And if you look at the Orion spacecraft, it's almost shaped like a tent or a water droplet. But that vehicle is going to be home for 10 days. But because of that, we will take less things with us. We have less exercise devices. And so some of the training will be similar, learning spacecraft propulsion data, cooling, communication systems. But the biggest difference is just the amount of logistics going with us, because we're only going for 10 days. We've got all our food, our clothing, And it's going to be a very busy mission, sort of like our space shuttle missions were, that mm-hmm. were on the order of 2 weeks. This mission is going to be a very dense 10 days of testing out the spacecraft and then eventually landing in the Pacific Ocean under the parachutes, making sure that heat shield worked.
Let's talk about this vehicle for a moment. And because as right now, so it's still being, I won't say configured, but it's still being put together in a sense.
Correct. Correct. It's currently out at Kennedy Space Center in something we call the Industrial Operations Zone. It's in the building we actually stay in. When you see the astronauts walk out of that building mm-hmm. to go get in the car or drive out to the launch pad, that's the Neil Armstrong Operations and Checkout Facility. And it's in that building in the IOZ, the Industrial Operations Zone. And it's I went and saw the vehicle in late March or early April. It looks like a spacecraft. You can tell it's a spaceship. It still has some pieces to be added to it, a few avionics boxes. The heat shield is going to be integrated soon, but mm-hmm. It's starting to look like a spaceship, and it's ready to go. It had parts from Artemis 1, the mm-hmm. first Orion we launched at the end of last year that we had to take off of the Artemis 1 capsule to put mm-hmm. on this one. But essentially, all the piece parts are there and ready to be integrated and then stacked on top of the rocket.
Have you had conversations with, we'll call them for the sake of this conversation, the OGs
yes.
of NASA and the astronauts? And what do they tell you?
Hey, you know, oh, this is so important. Look, the OGs are still around. And, you know, one of the most encouraging parts of this is to hear their excitement. Mm-hmm. Harrison Schmidt, Jack Schmidt, the only geologist that we sent to the moon in the Apollo program, he is very excited. He has strong opinions about what we should do and what kind of science this is going to open the door, what big questions we need to answer, and where we should go land on the moon. And so it's inspiring to see them excited. And I have a mentor who I took his astronaut pin to the International Space Station, yeah. Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Swikert.
Wow.
And I think there are plans for us to get together with them formally and sit down and just, you know, eat the crumbs off the table, if you will, just to learn from them and spend time with them. So, yes, and I will say they are very engaged in what NASA's doing. We have something called the ASAP. It's a panel that oversees what we're doing. And one of the members of that is a man named Tom Stafford, General mm-hmm. Tom Stafford. An OG, but he is still very active in his 90s, and he is still wow. going. He's still technically sharp, and to listen to him speak is just amazing. So, yes, we have the blessing and the support of the OGs.
And let's talk about your role here, because I think when I hear, well, the pilot is Captain Victor Glover. You don't say, welcome aboard, everybody. Now, do you?
I might. It's also important to have a little bit of fun. So, yeah. You know, put your seat backs and your tray tables in the full upright position as we get ready for takeoff. And out your left window, you'll see the Atlantic Ocean. And off your right side, you'll see the beautiful glades of Florida. So it's interesting. So, the roles in the vehicle are the commander, the pilot. Then we have a mission specialist mm-hmm. 1 and 2. And so, one, that determines which seat I'll sit in. I'll be on the commander's right side. Mm-hmm. And I will be in front of displays. I'll have hand controllers. But both of us will be able to fly the vehicle. And actually, one really important thing, we want to train up everybody. All of the mm-hmm. people in this spaceship are there to evaluate the vehicle, how it is to live and exercise and eat and sleep. We also want to know what they think about how we fly this vehicle. Mm-hmm. Because on future missions, while the commander and I are both test pilots, the future missions may have physicians, scientists, and engineers sitting at the controls. And so we want them to also fly this spaceship. But my primary responsibility, maybe that's the difference. My primary responsibility is to make sure the vehicle and its subsystems are configured to execute the mission.
I want to shift for a moment because I believe it was a fellow crew member that talked about the diversity of the entire Artemis II core. And it's taken quite a bit of time, but it's not like it used to be. We know that NASA has come a long way, but still has a long way to go in terms of that area. How would you assess what NASA's been able to do in terms of its diversity and making sure that, you know, this is obviously an industry, a field that not just can attract a diverse pool of candidates, but also keep them engaged and get young folks engaged early.
So vital. Well, let me put this in context. First and foremost, our country is experiencing something called the gray wave, the retirement of the baby boomer generation, and our science and technology workforce is going away faster than we're replacing it. The numbers of students studying science, technology, engineering, mathematics is decreasing. And so we need to inject support for STEM and science and technology and encourage kids to go out and do these very challenging things. They are very challenging career fields to get into, mm-hmm. but they're very rewarding. And so we need to encourage and inspire young people to make those kinds of decisions, those life decisions. And so it's important for this mission to represent all of America and really all of humanity. When we leave the planet, we represent humanity. I may wear an American flag on my left shoulder, but when we leave our country and our planet, we're representing humanity. And it's important for people to be able to connect to this mission. And so it is important that we are exploring for all people, but also by all people.
Now I want to go back a little further to little Victor Glover growing up in California. Who was this kid? Tell me about him.
Oh, man. This kid loved sports and food and had a mom and dad who loved him and a stepmom. I was born out of wedlock and you know, raised by two parents that I didn't always have them both at the same time. But, you know, we made it work. And so it's a little bit of a complicated childhood. But I tell you what. I didn't know it was complicated at the time. I just knew I had parents and grandparents who loved and supported me. And they are directly responsible for me being able to chase and catch some of my own dreams. And, you know, another thing I think is really important in this story is back then I used to love to take my toys apart and see what I could turn them into. And I'd try to turn a train into a plane and a race car into a robot. And so I would pick, you know, take things apart. And my parents and my grandparents tolerated it because, you know, it wasn't always a good thing to see me taking apart toys, but they were happy when I put them back together and didn't have a whole bunch of pieces left over.
When did you know space exploration, going to the moon? I don't know if you thought about going to the moon when you were 10, but when did that hit you?
Well, I say it came in waves. I didn't have this, like, you know, in my bones, I want to be an astronaut. I didn't know that field. I didn't really understand the steps to get there. I just saw people on TV launching and leaving the planet. And I thought, I want to drive that vehicle. I wanted to be a stuntman and a policeman like my father. And so I thought of, okay, that looks like a really amazing adventure. I used to sit in the backyard and stare up at the moon. And to this day, I still see a rabbit in the rocking chair on the moon with the ears flying back. And you know, I never really thought about going to it, but I was always fascinated by it, hearing that the tide and the ocean was responding to the gravity of the moon and seeing it full and then, you know, a new moon and all in eclipses. I just was amazed by all of that. And the fact that it always looked the same. And as I got older, it still looked the same. That was amazing. But at about 10 years old, seeing a shuttle launch on TV, it was motivating and inspiring, but I didn't have a real connection. I didn't see steps, and I definitely didn't see anybody in my life that I could mimic or ask questions about how to get there. So it's interesting. You used a word, when did I know? You know what, Rose? To be honest, I didn't know until I was 37 and they called me and said, do you want to come to Houston to start astronaut candidate training? And there's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there, but I don't know if we have time, but so I didn't have that certainty. I had a lot of self-doubt.
Because you were a naval aviator, right? A test pilot?
Yes, ma'am. And so being in test pilot school, I was in test pilot school and saw our current deputy administrator, Pam Melroy. She told the story. She was one of the first female shuttle commanders. And talking about her mission, that was definitely the moment I decided I am going to apply. I'm going to put in an application and see if I can join that team. But I didn't really expect to get much consideration. And that when I did in that round, I didn't have a master's degree. I wasn't complete with test pilot school, so I didn't go very far. Yeah. And then I applied the next time around and got the phone call.
I want to play something for you. And I'll let you navigate our conversation afterwards.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon.
Now, it's about 2 minutes long, and we'll definitely have the full version on our website, but I'll let you take it from here and why that is so important to you. That is the late Gil Scott Heron's Whitey on the Moon.
Yes, yes. So why is it so important to me? It's important to me because it represents a facet of this mission in our country that is misunderstood or even not understood at all, not even identified. And so when I showed up at NASA, knowing the importance of outreach, I made a point to not just go out into the public and try to educate the public on what NASA does. I made a point to try and educate NASA on where I'm from and what people of color deal with in the communities that we don't always reach. And my community, where I come from, I'm from Pomona, California. And so the song represents a facet of America that wasn't just cheering for Apollo in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. 1968 was a really a terrible year. Martin Luther King was assassinated. There were issues, the Vietnam War, protests in this country, protests all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting time. And when the moon astronauts came back in 1968, one of the letters they received was from someone that says, "Thank you, you've saved 1968." So what I wanted to do is to encourage astronauts and our engineers and flight directors and our team to think about the broader community and to think about what it means that people are still dealing with, you know, high prices and healthcare and potholes. And so to just be sensitive to the fact that we don't all have the same experience, and so that we can be sensitive to that and think about how what we're doing moves the needle for everybody. It's really instructive that in 1969, the Apollo 11 launch, one mm-hmm. of the most amazing moments in human history, mm-hmm. was protested by Ralph Abernathy and a group of folks that came out to Kennedy Space Center. Mm-hmm. And the NASA administrator said, if we could not push the button tomorrow and solve hunger and these problems that you're here to protest about, we would do that. But in fact, he said, I love these words. I want you to hitch your wagon to what we're doing at NASA. And tell people that NASA is an example of what this country can do. Mm-hmm. So when my colleagues say words like that, this is an example of what we do when we work together. We can do big things. I want them to be saying that with their heart and their arms around everybody.
So when someone says to you, and I don't know if you've, I'm assuming I probably shouldn't, if you've had these conversations, folks says, they say, well, why do we need to further explore going to the moon and then eventually Mars? And how does that, as, and this is quote coming from NASA, quote, paving the way for future for long-term human exploration missions to the moon and eventually Mars? Someone says, why?
Yes, yes. Because going to space requires us to have the things in this country that support better, more efficient, more effective, and eventually more affordable healthcare. It requires us to take our environment more serious, to think about power creation and generation and storage, using batteries more efficiently. The fact that we all walk around with little teeny devices in our pocket that can mm-hmm. translate language, tell us directions to get to the store and find cheap gasoline is all powered by technology that helped us get to the moon. And the fact that we can communicate so easily, those are just examples of the kinds of technologies that are benefiting us here on the ground mm-hmm. on Earth. This program has supported thousands. You talked about how many people are on the team to help make Artemis II work. Mm-hmm. Those people have very high quality science and technology jobs and have. We've been working on this for about 20 years. And so this is what it's about. It isn't just those lofty goals out in space. It's about what we do back here in our communities at home that is moving the needle for everybody.
And when you speak to kids, big and little, what's that one usual question you get?
Oh, okay. Well, I get a lot of them, but I what it's like to go to the bathroom, what looking at the planet was like the first time, that first view of Earth. And I like both of those. They both connect to the human experience, right? I'm a person.
Yeah.
And I've lived at sea level for most of my life. And so to be 400 kilometers or 250 miles above the surface of the Earth and look out without any device, no telescope, no microscope, and with these regular old human eyes, to see the beauty of this planet is just breathtaking.
Well, brace yourself, because I'm joined now by 12-year-old Sean and 8-year-old Arjun, and they have some questions. We're going to turn our camera around here for a second. All right. So can you see them?
Come up.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, bring that microphone over there. This is a brand new microphone, Arjun. Don't break it now, okay?
Hi, Sean. Hi, Arjun.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay, now who wants to go first? Arjun, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first.
What's your question?
My question is, how long does it take to get to the moon and back?
Oh, great question. I'm glad you put to get back. That's important. So for this mission, for Artemis 2, we're going to launch and we're going to do 2 laps around the Earth within the first day. And then when we actually burn the engines to go to the moon, that's the same energy that's going to get us back to Earth. But the way to the moon is going to take about 4 days. 4 days, the gravity of Earth will kind of slow us down. And then the gravity of the moon, as we get closer, will speed us up and pull us toward the moon. And so 4 days we'll get there, and it'll take about 4 days to get back. Just to compare, though, so this mission will be about 9 days and some hours, 10 days total. Just to compare, though, there are missions that have gotten the distance to the moon faster. We launched the New Horizons spaceship, which was going all the way to Pluto to take pictures, and it got to the moon. That same moon we're talking about, it's going to take us 4 days. It got there in 8 hours. So it was going a whole lot faster. So it depends on the mission and what's on it and how heavy it is. But for our mission, it'll be 4 days there and 4 days back.
All right. You got another one?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you eat in space?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think I would go if they didn't let us eat in space. Yeah, we take our food with us, and so we have special food that can last a long time, similar to the military meals ready to eat, or camping food, if you've ever had camping food. But unfortunately, we don't take Tang, and we don't have freeze-dried ice cream up there. Oh. But I wish we did.
All right. And Sean, what's your question?
So my question is, you know how when something's going really fast, it sets on fire? Would, like, the parachute burn up too? Like, how does it engage even though the capsule is heating up?
Oh, great question. The capsule is going so fast that when we come back from the moon, it'll be going about 7 miles per second. And that's so fast that the air around it turns into a plasma. It's like riding inside of a fireball. You're right. The air just vaporizes. It's so hot. And that's due to friction. So to get rid of that energy and protect the spaceship and the crew, we have a heat shield that burns off. It dissipates. It gets rid of that energy by burning the heat shield off. And so the first thing that slows us down is actually not the parachutes. It's the atmosphere. The air that we breathe that's around the Earth, that atmosphere is also the first thing that slows us down. And then once the atmosphere slows us down, we have a series of parachutes that come out. And the smaller ones come out first, and then they pull out the bigger parachutes, and then the parachutes open slowly to not have too much air go in them so that the parachutes are safe. That great question. We definitely have to protect those parachutes.
Got another question?
How does it feel when the other stages of the rocket drop?
Oh, good question. So I've only done that once. And the Falcon rocket that I rode on top of, when that staging happened, it was like you were accelerating and being pushed back into your seat. And then it felt like someone tapped the brakes, and I leaned forward toward the displays. And then when the engine lit up again, it pushed me back into my seat. So I definitely felt that. It was like speeding up, slowing down, and then speeding up again as I was pushed back in the seat. And we continued to accelerate for 6 more minutes to get to space. That was pretty amazing.
How much fun do you have speaking with kids?
I love it. This is one of my favorite parts of the job. No kidding. I love to fly, but I love to fly because I love talking about it with kids and the excitement that is connected to aerospace. And so in another part too, though, I am also responsible for finding my replacement. So the next generation of astronauts is out there, and the sooner we can identify them and encourage them, Sean and Arjun, to work hard and to do your best and to be good to each other and to your classmates, and to become good, responsible citizens. That's a big part of what I do, and I take that very seriously.
Captain Glover, as we wrap up, you just a moment ago talked about what it's like to be 250 miles looking down on planet Earth. Can you put into words what your journey has been like thus far? And if you had anything to tell, and I know it's a cliche question, but I'm a journalist, I'm going to ask it anyway. If you had something to tell 10-year-old Victor Glover, what would it be?
This journey has been, I have to use this word, enchanted. It's been blessed. It's been better than what I would have thought if I had to write it out. If I had a genie in a bottle and I could have wished for it, I wouldn't have wished for it to be this good. I have a wife who loves and tolerates me and four kids who are amazing and chasing their own dreams. And I work very hard for them. And I'm glad folks encouraged me to study something challenging and to go into a job that I could pour my all into. And for all the challenges, it's just like going to the gym. You can't run fast if you don't try to run fast sometimes. You have to work hard to become good at something. And those challenges turned into education and training and skills, things I could do with my hands and my brain. And on the way, I've made some great friends and had some really amazing adventures. But most important, I've been a part of some really amazing teams, starting with my family and now NASA and our Navy. And so when I think back to 10-year-old me who didn't know any college graduates, didn't know engineers and scientists, and never really understood what it meant to be an astronaut, just I wanted to drive a space shuttle. What I would tell myself has changed. I used to just say I would tell myself that it will be okay because I had a lot of worry, a lot of self-doubt. I didn't see myself going to college, definitely to study engineering. But here's what I need to add to that, because it worked out because I listened to those people, the OGs. I listened to the mentors. And so it's going to be okay because you're going to do the work. That's what I would say to the 10-year-old me. It's going to be okay because you're going to work hard.
Captain Victor Glover Jr., a member of the NASA and the Canadian Space Agency's astronauts who will venture around the moon, or moonish, as they say, on Artemis II. Artemis II is currently set to launch in late 2024. Captain Glover, can I call you Victor now?
Oh, please call me Victor, yes.
Now, I was trying to be, you know, keep the proper protocol, but Vic, can I call you Vic?
Yes, of course.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for also speaking with these young folks here. That's always, always so important.
Rose, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for sharing the news of Artemis and our adventure. And Sean and Arjun, thank you for getting up early to join us. It was great to hear your questions.
All right. Take care now.
Take care.
To the moon and back. That's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder, let me know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. Stay tuned to WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.